any of us who've been in it for long enough, our entire career has been littered with jobs that we didn't get, projects that we thought were going to go for sure, dozens of unproduced scripts littering the floor.
All of us are running into both major and minor failures in Hollywood every single day.
For every success, there is months, sometimes even years, of painful failure.
This is one of the only businesses I can think of where failure is the default. That's the norm. You have to be able to persevere.
Like everything in our business, your hands get calloused and it all bounces off you. That process takes years. That doesn't happen overnight.
I was being told by my manager, it's yours to lose. And I promptly lost it. And I remember thinking like, well, that's it for me. I blew my one big shot. What I've realized from that moment is it's never one big shot. There will be other shots.
Welcome back to Screaming Into the Hollywood Abyss, a podcast about rejection, failure, and adversity in the entertainment industry. As ever, I'm your non-entertainment co-host, Dan Rutstein, and we have on the other side of the Zoom, Noah.
Hey, Dan, how you doing? And hello, world. I am super excited to introduce Chuck Wendig to the podcast. Chuck is an author, blogger, screenwriter, and graphic novelist. On top of the New York Times bestselling book Wanderers, he also wrote the Miriam Black thrillers, the Atlanta Burns novels, and most recently, The Book of Accidents, as well as a screenplay for the 2018 feature film, You Might Be the Killer. Chuck has also written in the Star Wars universe with his Star Wars Aftermath book series and the Force Awakens graphic novel series. And that's just the tip of the iceberg for this prolific writer. Welcome, Chuck.
Hi, I'm a rifer too. It's fine. I rife all the time. How you doing? Thanks for having me.
It's great. It's perfect setup for the show. Obviously, Noah making a complete mess of the intro. So it puts us on a right tone immediately. So I've got a sort of, I guess it's an adversity question. And I think it falls in the adversity box, depending on how you answer this. So Star Wars fans have obviously earned the reputation for being sort of fair-minded, open, welcome to new ideas. They really like people sort of moving around with the franchise and trying different things and being very kind to people on social media.
Totally the kindest.
So how was it for you being part of that world?
It was weird. It was a very strange experience. And there's two sort of different sides to it. There's the online side and there's the in-person side. And the in-person side, every fan I've met, literally to the person, has been wonderful. Online, it's not always quite that way. And the perfect dichotomy of that is like when we released the first book of the Aftermath series, it was at a midnight release at Dragon Con, but in a Barnes & Noble. And so midnight rolls around and it's Force Friday and we release the book and there's all these people and these fans there and I read some chapters and we sell some books and I'm like out of there by 2 a.m. So it was a good event. And at 2 a.m, I decided to check Amazon on my phone and I already see that there's like a dozen one-star reviews of the book. And I was like, that's weird. I feel like, why are there one-star reviews already? And then all weekend, I would go to Dragon Con and I would have these panels and I would meet all these fans. It'd be super exciting. Then I would find a little corner and get some signal and look at Amazon and it'd be 50 one-star reviews or 100. And I was like, oh, this is, something's happened. So it was this strange sort of like these two sides of a fandom approaching the book in very different ways.
So obviously, given we've had a global pandemic and you've not been able to do very much in person for a while, I guess you will have seen more of the negative than the positive. Do you just really want to go into a room full of people who are nice to you rather than, just
be much nicer? I would prefer that. Yeah. Though thankfully I haven't had to, I haven't been too involved in Star Wars in a while, especially since I think technically you could argue they let me go from doing comics to do my politics. So I am free and clear of Star Wars. And maybe it was one of the better things that has happened.
So that feels like it's sort of rejection, which is,
it's definitely a kind of rejection. Yes.
Yeah. Tell us that story.
So it was, I was doing some, obviously worth the 3 books. And then I was doing some comics work for Marvel on the Star Wars side of things. And I had done some superhero stuff for them too. And it was New York Comic Con, and it was happening, it was coinciding with the Kavanaugh hearings, the Brett Kavanaugh, the SCOTUS. So I, along with what I feel like was a not insignificant number of people, were pretty salty about how those proceedings were going. Obviously, you had, you know, Brett Kavanaugh up there being Brett Kavanaugh and all of the, you know, Christine Blasey Ford stuff. So I was salty about that online and using four-letter words to describe my saltiness. And then I went to Comic-Con to announce that I was writing a new series for Marvel Star Wars, a Darth Vader series. And that went well, and it was a good experience. And then I came back. And during the following week, the sort of alt-right first comic, the group known as Comicsgate picked it up. And it went sort of around that sort of, you know, like the YouTube people who get angry because, like, there's a Black Widow movie or Shang-Chi there. Like, it flopped. It secretly flopped. We have the secret conspiracy that tells you how it flopped. And so those people got a hold of it and were very not happy that this uppity Star Wars writer was daring to get mean about the Supreme Court judge. So it got picked up from there by some particularly big alt-right kind of figureheads, like a Dinesh D'Souza type. Well, I mean, literally him, Kurt Schilling, like a lot of those pundits, James Woods, like those guys all picked it up and got really mad at me. And then next thing I know, I was getting a phone call from Marvel a week later, and they were like, yeah, no, you're being kicked off the job. You're done with that Star Wars thing here. And it's, you know, I was like, well, it's because of my politics. And they're like, well, it's because of your vulgarity about your politics. And we don't appreciate that. And I couldn't get an answer as to where it came from. I mean, they have obviously Marvel entangled people up there, even to the point of the person who ran the company was sort of apparently shadow running the Veterans Department at that point. But I also know Disney is famously sort of hands off and gun shy about stuff like that. So I was there, and then suddenly I wasn't. And they didn't want me to go public with it. They wanted me to say that I was just like a freelancer who couldn't hack this work. And so I chose to, you know, back out of it. And I didn't want to do that because I felt like that was going to look poorly on me. So I was like, no, I'm going to talk about this, because comics wasn't my world anyway. So I was like, if I burn that bridge, that's a bridge that's burned. And I would rather own what happened, all of it, snout to tail, than sort of get caught up in sort of lying about it, especially like, you know, having to throw myself under a bus for no good reason. So it was a gnarly, messy thing. We went to the Washington Post and they did a big article on it. And then I think it was Vox.com did like a huge thing about all the bot traffic that got around it and how most of the negative tweets about me were bot driven. And it was a fascinating experience in a very bad way, but then got good.
The sort of principle of the separation between the artist and the art and the artist's views in today's world of social media. Obviously, it cuts both ways, because there was an actress who appeared in The Mandalorian, and everyone thought she was amazing in The Mandalorian, yeah. And no right. one questioned her acting ability at any point, quite the opposite. Right. But a lot of people questioned her political views, yes. And then there was a whole, you know, cancelled, not cancelled, where were Disney on it, that sort of thing. Obviously, a lot of this is a social media phenomenon, or at least yes. it speeds it up.
It does, yeah.
What is the answer? Is it that everyone should just make art and be neutral, or actually you can separate people from the work they do or they can't? Like, you've been in it, so what yeah. conclusions have you drawn?
I don't have any good answers there. I just know that I, for my mileage, I'd rather be me. And, you know, I never really subscribe to the view that artists should somehow remain neutral, because who else is uniquely primed to at least speak about these things? That doesn't mean artists are right about stuff either. But I mean, we're citizens just like anybody else. So I don't feel like we should be kept out of the discourse just because we have books out or comics or movies or whatever it is. So, you know, I feel like you should own that and be that. And there's reality that comes with sharing those views, whether it be a social media thing. And of course, social media can turn an ember into a conflagration pretty quickly. And then the whole house is burning down around your ears without realizing. But, you know, that's also maybe part of the price of being alive and being an artist, is, you know, saying things and owning things and being who you are, regardless of what any sort of corporate owner might think about it.
No regrets?
No. Actually, it was the best thing, because I did. So there's something kind of seductive about Star Wars. Like, you kind of get in and it's not really your fan base, but you're kind of thrust into this massive group of people who want to talk to you about things. And like, your books are selling really well and it's very exciting, but a lot of those people don't necessarily jump ship and come see you for your other non-Star Wars books. So it reminded me to focus on the stuff that's mine, like the stuff I own. I mean, just on a very simple level, like I would rather not only artistically own what I'm working on, but also be able to use that long tail of royalties and foreign rights sales and film and television licensing and things like that, that are going to help me as a writer, where I can't do that with Star Wars. It's like, it's a one and done deal. Like, I don't get, you know, one of my characters is in The Mandalorian, I don't get a cent for it. So this is how it is.
This is also interesting. I realized as you're telling the story that you came to my, on my radar during that whole, you know, phenomenon with Star Wars. And I think I liked a few of your tweets before that, because you had a few viral tweets, because you have a very pithy way of describing humans and other things. And yeah. And then you had this whole thing, this really open discussion of what happened with you and Disney. And I think maybe at the time I was working for ABC or whatever, so very cognizant of the rules, so to speak, and, you know, social media, and also trying to figure out, you know, how I wanted to present myself on social media on a much smaller level. How transparent do I want to be? How open do I want to be? And I decided that, you know, I wanted to be fairly transparent and fairly open. And there was people that I liked and respected who had careers and who were able to put themselves out there, like you, who were transparent. But, you know, there is a discussion going on right now in writers' rooms and in Hollywood and around the industry about social media. And the fact that today it often can hurt you more than it can help you.
I think the juice is not worth the squeeze anymore. Absolutely.
You know, now that I'm kind of leaning us back into a little bit of process questions, I do have we normally have a lot of screenwriters on this podcast who dabble in novels. Yeah. Right. You are you're a novelist, first and foremost, New York Times bestseller. You have a lot of books who you also write screenplays, but it feels like the ratio is reversed. And I've been puzzling over this, that it feels like there's not a ton of crossover, where a lot of screenwriters write novels, a lot of novels write screenplays, but very few people do both well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm wondering about your process. Have you seen that? And do you want to write more screenplays? Are you happy writing novels? Do you like scratching both itches, so to speak?
I definitely like scratching both itches. The thing about a writer is, I think any writer in any industry probably, they kind of dig their own tunnel and then blow it up behind them. Like, everybody always wants to know how you did it, but like, my path is as circuitous as any. Like, I was trying to write novels and I was doing that very badly. And then on a lark, I entered a screenwriting competition, and the prize was a mentorship with another screenwriter, Steven Susko, who did the Grudge films. And his whole kind of thing was adapting pre-existing material to the screen. And so I was like, well, I want to try to win this so I can get his wisdom on how to translate my own broken novels to the screen and then back to a novel. Like, I really didn't, like, film was not where I wanted to land with it. I mostly just wanted story help and was looking for any sort of expert to do that. So I inadvertently did actually win. And he really helped me sort of understand story, but also really gain a love for writing screenplays. And he hooked me up with a friend of his who became my writing partner for a number of years. And Lance Wyler, who did Last Broadcast, which sort of preceded Blair Witch in its kind of found footage horror film vibe. And, you know, we ended up at the Sundance Screenwriters Lab, and we had a short film at Sundance the year after. And it was sort of we had a pilot, and that's a whole crazy rejection failure story. I kind of started there even really before getting any traction with novels. And it was only once I kind of picked back into the novel thing that it was like, well, Hollywood sort of moved aside, just because that's, you know, the time to do novels is somewhat significant to sort of churn through that. And it's a very different situation, you know. Writing a comic book and writing a screenplay are very similar. Like, you kind of start at the bottom, you're kind of doing these bare bones things, and then a lot of other people are going to be involved in that process. But writing a novel is like, you just sort of hand this brick of material to an editor and you're like, I don't know, let's hope that that's it, because there's not much else to do with it after that.
Well, you know, as a failure, reduction failure and adversity podcast, I want to, you mentioned there was a story and a failed pilot, but, and we can come to that story, but I also want to talk about, this isn't a failure, so to speak, but it's, we had Glenn Mazzara on our podcast who, I think was adapting Your Wanderers before the pandemic. And I think he brought up a little bit of the story. I don't think he mentioned your name, but I knew it was you who had written that book. And, you know, you write a book, it does really well, New York Times bestseller, your trajectory of your career, everything is going really well. Hollywood comes calling, they buy your book. You have a great, Glenn Mazzara has a great track record. This guy's now adapting your book. Yeah. Are you beginning to sort of, you know, your bank account's filling up, you're beginning, and then obviously something out, completely outside of everyone's control happens. There's an actual pandemic and your project tanks. But what's that emotional process for you of sort of dealing with the loss of that TV project?
It's both frustrating and unsurprising, like, because, you know, I've had, I think most of my books at some point or another have probably been option. Actually, my first novel, Blackbirds, has never been out of option. It's just always someone either new is picking it up or it gets extended for a little while. And sometimes it has, I mean, we were at Stars for a long time and they had, you know, offices and some location scan, and then it just sort of deflates. And I always say that the thing is, the difference for me that I've noticed between, you know, like New York publishing and kind of the film and TV world of LA is, like, in New York publishing, everything is, with some exception, no before it's yes. Right. You submit the thing and it's like, this is not good. No. Or you submit it. But finally you kind of get a yes from an agent, a yes from an editor. Next thing you know, your book is eventually going to be on a bookshelf. But in Hollywood, it's yes before it's no. Everyone loves you. They want to be in the you business. They love all that you've done. Pitch us this, pitch us that. Oh man, this is going to be huge. And then next thing you know, it kind of does the, well, not really. And then it just stops one day. And so I've kind of gotten used to it. Like, I'm not mad at it, but I'm just sad. Mostly the saddest thing about all of that is not about the opportunity to lose Wanderers on a screen, but the loss of Glenn, because Glenn really understood the material. Obviously, he's someone who works at a high level of storytelling and understands all that stuff and all the bricks and mortar of it. And so just to sort of have that fall away from the project was the greatest loss for me, because part of the joy for me for doing these options is not the expectation that it's ever going to get made, but the chance to sort of get to work with people like him. And it's really, I cherish that time, and I'm, you know, hope I get to work with him again someday.
So I get, it's a hypothetical, but I just, we'll ask this and see where it goes to. So if you had a choice between writing a book and it flying straight to the top of the book charts, but remains only a book, will ever only be a book.
Yeah.
Writing a book that does below average compared to your other books, but ends up being a TV show and you get to work with a sort of Glenn Mazzara-esque person and adapting it, and it's a big success, albeit, you know, it comes a bit later and your book didn't do well on its own, or actually just writing something straight for TV and that being a success. Which of those three would be your optimal?
Oh, that's tough. Probably the middle road there, because the book is still the book and the book is always going to exist as a book. And if it then leaps the fence, right, and gets to be this other thing, which, if the book by itself was not a huge success, usually going to film or TV will at least give it a little more juice in terms of its sales. Like I said, that long tail for novelists is a real thing. And then getting to work with great people and have that be out there in two different forms, I think is probably that's where the maximum value would enter in for me, at least emotionally. Yeah.
And I guess as a result of knowing that is the case, now, particularly given you have had successes, you know, for your next books, if they don't jump the fence, as you say, but still do incredibly well just as books, does that make them, will they start in your head starting to become sort of partial disappointments as a result? Because you've now got an idea, you want to do this, and you've got, you know, were it not for a global pandemic, you actually probably would have achieved that.
Yeah, not really. I don't think it, but it's like not getting dessert. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't expect dessert. But I'd like it. I'd really like it to be great. Dessert is wonderful. But if I don't get it, I'm also not upset about it if the meal was satisfying. So, the book is always the goal. I mean, that's always why I'm in it and what I'm doing. It's just having it sort of become something different is always an interesting, and it's just something that hasn't happened yet really in a big way for me, in terms of a literal book to film or TV translation. I'd like to see that, but it wouldn't be a disappointment. It's business as usual, really.
It was interesting that obviously your point about the no before the yes and the yes before you know, that's quite an interesting way of describing it. We know from having had lots of screenwriters on here about the number of pitches that just don't go anywhere and so on. From your point of view, let's talk about some projects that have died for you in terms of either books you've actually finished and have just no one wants to have anything to do with them, or ideas for things that just no one wants you to pursue. Just tell us a bit about sort of some of the failures, and I'd be interested in the sort of volume of failures to success in terms of things that actually make it into print compared to those that don't.
Well, early on, the volume of failure to success is heavily weighted toward the failures, because, you know, they call them trunk novels in my case, almost for a literal reason. I would much rather those novels be buried in a trunk, a lead line trunk, preferably 6 feet deep in my backyard. So will never expose the audience to whatever sort of foul septic fumes are coming off. And they were horrible. I wrote terrible novels early on. I would try to ping agents with them, and I would get just, you know, very polite, but whatever kind of meh responses from them. You know, I've tried to sort of ding into creator-owned comics, which is its own chaotic place. And a lot of times that's a no. So that's where, if I have sort of no's, they're still happening. But now at this point, in terms of the books, they're still generally occurring. But like when I first wrote my the original novel, Blackbirds, my first original novel released into the world, it took, I had some funky agent stories, just people who, you know, were yes and no or hot and cold. But then getting it to a publisher was kind of a nightmare, because I would get these rejections that were like the nicest, best rejections that were, because of their niceness and their opinion, they were all the more crushing. Like, I would get routinely again and again, like, we love this book so much. It's great. All of our team loves it, and we'll never be able to sell it. So no. And it'd be like, well, okay. And I would literally be like, well, then what do we need to change? At the time, I was still like new. Like, I wasn't so artistically committed to the story. I'm like, what does it need? Like, a ghost detective, a talking dog. What can we put in this thing that will turn this no to a yes? And be like, no, we like it as it is. We just can't sell the book as it is. If you changed it, then we're not going to like it anymore. And it feels like insane but then it's still a no. And you would just constantly bang my head against these really, really wonderful rejections for about a year and a half. And it wasn't until a couple small British publishers sort of picked up the book and kind of did like a tiny little back forth auction on it that it ever actually got the juice to come out.
Yeah. British people, very good.
They are so, yeah, general. That's true. The best.
He jumped the gun on that. I knew there was going to be a joke there. What do you think, you know, as we're talking about IP and creating IP, this is going to sound like a very sterile question, but on our side of the fence here, when we're writing screenplays, the networks and studios don't want us to show up without IP, without your book, so to speak. We can't, right. They don't want us to pitch our original ideas don't count.
Yeah.
And yet they want to have your, you know, someone like you having written a book, and we can walk in with the books, they can have read the book, and there's fans. Do you face the same, like, what kind of pressures do you face in the publishing industry about sort of pre-existing IP? Do they want original stuff? What do they want from someone like you now that you're sort of at the top of your game?
Generally original work now. They are, you know, both comics and books are, I think, happy to be a generative place for intellectual property, for film, television, or for foreign rights editions, or whatever it's going to be, games, wherever it goes from there. There are usually opportunities to write in other people's licensed worlds. They're not usually super rewarding, and they're usually not super financially rewarding as well. There's usually some fraught language and how that gets, sometimes there's not even royalties and then it ends up being quite literally work for hire and not, a real kind of novel situation. So I don't generally get asked too much, mostly because I have a pretty blanket no with my agent. There's only a few properties I'd be like, yeah, I would work on that kind of regardless of how it pays me or what it's going to do. But I don't really own it and I can't do much with it beyond pay a mortgage. And not that there's anything wrong with paying a mortgage, obviously, please believe me. But if I can pay a mortgage and then pay my next mortgage because, I'm getting royalties on a book that earns out, then it's better for me to own kind of my own thing and do my own stuff with it.
I'm speaking of on our side of the fence, we agonize over all kinds of things as screenwriters. You know, are we going to sell again? The business is constricting. We don't have any buyers. I mean, we have buyers that don't want our stuff. The pandemic, all of this stuff.
And it's weirder now, right? It's harder now.
It's like impossible. This last year for, many of the people that come on this podcast and other top notch writers, there's just the market has constricted. Pitches are flailing. People aren't selling. They're just like, it might be slowly changing as we speak right now. Like things are kind of reopening up, but the Hollywood overbought during the pandemic and then couldn't make as much as they wanted. So they had this huge backlog of stuff and we still need to kind of feed that machine. More importantly, we need to feed our families.
Yeah.
And that's the things that keep us up at night. On your side of the fence, as a novelist, and you have to self-generate as well. If you don't write new novels, you're not paying for the things that you need to pay for. But
right.
what keeps you up at night, about your business, about your industry, and especially now that brick and mortar's gone or mostly gone, like on your side of the industry?
On the good news, some of the brick and mortars are back, and indie bookstores have, over the course of the pandemic, done much better than anyone expected, which is good. And Barnes & Noble is also retrofitting their stores and doing some changes, so that's also good. But kind of the two things right now that are really challenging is, number one, the fact that in film and television, everybody's hitting a wall now. So, from June to August, it was like a dead zone. There was nobody selling anything. Like you said, they kind of overbought early on. So all these novels that are coming out, only really recently have I started to get kind of new interest in anything I've written in terms of translating it to that medium. Obviously, we don't rely on that for income, but it's one of those things where, again, it's kind of nice. The other thing that's really troubling is the supply chain. We are experiencing, like I had a book that was coming out on October 5th, my first middle grade. And suddenly I got an email last week, I guess, from my publisher that's like, well, supply chain issues are going to move your date. And so we didn't know. And it's kind of a really like a Halloween kind of book. Like it's a creepy, fun kids book. So to be moved out of October would have been a nightmare. Thankfully, they only moved it for 2 weeks. So it still lands kind of smack in the center of October. So we're still in an okay place. But that was like terrifying just to think that like because of paper problems and shipping from China, because China does most of the printing for the publishing industry. The pandemic, that all of the sort of cascading economical issues that have rippled out were worrisome, and it's still happening. I know there's people who were having books out in 2021 who have been literally moved to 2022, which in the way publishing pays, they're only paying you really when a book is coming out. So it's deferring, any income you're hoping to get from it. And if you were counting on that, that's now a new problem for you. So yeah, it's really tough stuff.
So there's been a bit of a debate over the last few months, and this is to do with movies. Different people have been on different sides of this debate, because obviously films, until actually I think Shang-Chi the other day, most films were coming out on streaming platforms at the same time as movie theaters because they were shut. And there's a question about, is it the same experience? Is it being made for film? For you as a writer, this is nothing to do with the pandemic. This has been over the last few years. Do you care if somebody reads your book in a book, or if they read it on a Kindle or other type of electronic device? Do you?
Nope, don't care. I really don't care. Those are to me like just containers for the story that I wrote. It's still words. I mean, it's not. And I think it's different from film because film has so many layers of experience to it. For good and for bad, you know, going to the theater and having food with you and the way the sound is and the way the projection is. And, you know, then moving it to the home market and with your television and everything, there's all these really layers of experiences. But for the most part, books are like, you either have a physical book, which we all know what that is, or we have an ebook, and there's some variation there in what that looks like. But even now, generally speaking, you can get an ebook that looks like the actual print book on the, I mean, you know, the fonts are the same and the spacing is the same. So it's not functionally that different. The only time it gets a little, you know, really kind of changes the and transforms from the print is when it becomes an audio book, and then it's a little more performed. But even there, I don't, it's not, doesn't bother me. If that's how people prefer to experience it, then that is all the power to them. And, or if it ever goes to film and television, more power to them. They can experience the work wherever they so choose. I'm not particularly a purist about the format it lands in.
Noted. And apologies to our listeners that that was a question that was nothing to do with redaction failure or adversity. But it's just fascinating having an author on. I can't help myself but ask that question because I've always wondered that. And actually, slightly self-indulgently, I'm going to ask you another question that's not really to do with redaction failure and adversity. Although it might be, depending on your answer. So you are Chuck Wendig. You've got 184-ish thousand followers on Twitter. You've written books that people have heard of. People know who you are. You're successful. Is there a part of you who wants to do what J.K. Rowling did and secretly write a book under a different name just to see if you can still write a book that stands as a book without anyone buying it because they wanted to buy it because it was you who wrote it?
Yeah, I've tried.
I've actually tried.
My middle grade coming out next, I wanted to do a pseudonym for it, like a Lemony Snicket type of thing, just because I was like, well, you know, I am an adult presence online. I'm very R-rated, as it were. And my adult books are definitely not for the faint of heart. So I was like, well, I don't really want, you know, kids that are like my age, like Googling me and being like, oh my God. But the publisher was like, no, we don't care about that. And that's not usually an issue. And we want the name. And I was like, oh, it's terrifying to me that you think my name has any value at all in this world. I was really hoping for like, oh, what kind of wacky fun pseudonyms can I come up with? And they're like, nope, none. It's you.
But your reason for doing it wasn't a sort of, does my art stand alone? It was more, you just want to protect young people from your profanity.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I was like, oh, maybe I should be careful about that. But as it turns out, that's not too much of a big deal. So,
okay. Right.
I mean, in a just quick related, I feel like you're, you know, having read a number of your books now that you've sort of come into, your voice has really solidified over the years, and you coming into this, like, what is uniquely yours through all the different books that you're writing, what might be hard to jump away from at this second if I was the writer going, no, this is my voice, this is me, I'm not quite sure I want to put a new name on that.
Yeah, especially with adult work, I definitely wouldn't want to change that at that point.
Well, you know, we're coming to the time of our podcast where we ask our last question, and the question that we always ask people normally in, you know, screenwriters and actors in the business is if you had a piece of advice for anybody coming up in this business, in your case, a novelist, what would it be?
I mean, it's increasingly weird because as I get more and more into this writing thing, I realize I know less and less. You know, Wanderers was the book that taught me I don't know how to write a book. And like, that was the best thing ever, that I didn't know how to write a book. Everything I thought I knew about how I wrote books became untrue. And then the pandemic challenged that additionally, with writing the Wanderer sequel and editing, both Dustin Grimm and Book of Accidents. Like, I realized I am, just a boat without a sail on the ocean. And I kind of like that because it changes the experience every time. So my advice, has kind of dwindled to like what I would actually tell people. Like, I don't feel like I have any merit to give them rock solid advice, but in the vein of sort of being a podcast about rejection and failure and all that stuff, I always say that failure is an instruction manual written in scar tissue. We view it, you know, kids go to school, right? And everybody wants, like, nobody wants to fail. Failing is the bad thing. That's like the worst thing you can do in school, but it's also like the most important thing you do in life is getting stuff wrong and taking as many sort of shots at the goal as you can, and examining every time you didn't do it and every time you almost did it and didn't quite get there. There's so much to learn in failure that I think when we demonize it, it's a bad thing. So I try to have people celebrate failure. I mean, at least to a point. Obviously, it never feels like amazing. You know, like, yeah, I did it. I completely didn't do anything. But to sort of view those things as like, even if it's just the rubble and garbage that you're crashing down upon the earth becomes a hill that you can climb onto and get further than you were before. And so that's sort of my lesson, is embrace failure and enjoy it.
Fantastic. This might actually end up being the last episode of this podcast, because I think we should rename it An Instruction Manual Written in Scar Tissue. Could be the name of our new podcast launching.
So,
unless you've got copyright on it, I don't know.
I don't, but I will. You have to have me on periodically.
Look, Chuck, this has been absolutely fascinating. A slight departure from what we normally do going into books, but really interesting hearing your versions of rejection, failure, and adversity. So thank you very much for your good humor and your patience. It's been wonderful to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you, Chuck.
Thanks, Del.
Thank you for listening to another one of our fantastic episodes. Yet again, I think you'll find that I ask better questions than Noah. Noah, have you got anything to say?
As always, since you've done most of the talking, I'm just going to sit here quietly again.
Surely there's some people to thank.
Oh, right. I would love to thank James Launch for doing all of our outro music. As always, I think we owe a big thank you to both of our wives who support us through this endeavor that started in our basement and seems to be ever growing. And if you want to reach out to either Dan or I am at N. Evselyn on Twitter. I'm not sure Dan has a Twitter account. Dan, do you have a Twitter account?
I mean, I do, but no one cares. All they care about is being on Noah's podcast. So well done, Noah, for conceiving, producing, editing, writing, and asking the best questions of the two of us, because you've done all this work, and well done you.
I do think it's worth pointing out after 33 or so episodes that I do both voices. There actually is no Dan Redstein.